Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. You might have heard that the Here We Still Stand conference is sold out, guys. It's sold out. It's all full up. But fear not. If you were like, how am I going to get a hold of that good content? Well, just for you who has just waited too long, or maybe you just weren't able to make it, we have a live stream sign up. And of course, this sign up is free. So you can sign up and you can see all the plenary sessions just streamed right to your phone, right to your computer, whatever you want to, however you want to partake in it. And all you got to do is go to the website and you can just click on the event. You can see a link to register for the live stream there. Or there's a link in the show notes that says HWSS live stream. And you can just click that link. It takes you over to the page. You just type in your email address and we will send you the appropriate links so that you can tune in to the live stream. That is October 13th through the 15th. So go ahead and take advantage of that. Sign up. Maybe you're just someone who only listens to 30 minutes. This is your only relationship with 1517, but you like it and you want to know kind of, hey, what is this 1517 doing? This would be a great chance for you to hear a bunch of speakers. You know, if you're someone who just happens to enjoy the podcast, sign up for the live stream. It doesn't cost you anything. You just get a link, and then you can watch what you want to watch. And I think that would be a good thing for you to do. So go ahead and take advantage of that. Costs you absolutely nothing, just like the gospel. Eric, we are in Amen. John chapter 19.
Yep, we're in John chapter 19, right in the middle of the trial and eventual crucifixion of Jesus. And really, we're going to be there, obviously, throughout most of our time today and for the next couple weeks until we come to the end of John's gospel. We pick it up in verse 1. It says, "Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him." Now, Dan, one of the things that I always want to take note of when we're reading the gospel accounts of this whole series of events in the life of Jesus is how little emphasis the writers give to this aspect of Jesus's crucifixion. Just says simply, "Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him." But of course, history tells us that what goes into this flogging is incredibly brutal. Obviously, if there's people listening to this podcast that have seen the movie The Passion of the Christ, then you know a little bit what goes into this kind of flogging. The cat of nine tails, the whip with nine different shards of glass or pieces of rock or whatever on the end of it, meant to completely tear open the back of the victim being flogged. Yet John does not give much detail here. He just tells us that it happened. But I think it's important to note that that is exactly what happens when this event takes place.
You know, what's strange about it is that we are coming right off the heels of Pilate trying to release Jesus. He said, "Look, I don't understand what's going on here. I don't find this man guilty of anything. Why don't I just release him to you? You know, I always release a prisoner on the Passover. I'll release him." They cry out for Barabbas, the insurrectionist. That's who they get. And so then Pilate is stuck having to do something with this other guy. And so he says, "I'm going to have him flogged. And then presumably that will be enough." And you would think, you know, that would be enough, because for a man that he doesn't think has done anything, this is a horrific punishment.
This is a horrific beating. And you get the sense that, like you're saying, Pilate is trying to pacify the mob that is crying out for the blood of Christ. And so, okay, I'll give you some blood. Yeah. I'll show that I'm willing to go halfway here. But that, of course, is not going to be sufficient. They want Jesus gone. They want him dead.
Yeah, I mean, and this has got to be shocking to Pilate. Like, he has to believe that surely this is enough because of how extreme this is.
That's right. Nevertheless, we read in verse 2, "And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe." And, of course, this is all mocking the idea that he is, in fact, the king of the Jews. And so, yes, they're going to give him a crown, but it's going to be a crown with very, very long and thick thorns on it pressed into his head, and then they array him in the color of royalty, which was this purple robe. all done in, of course, mockery. And so what we see here is something that we need to understand about the whole process of the death of Christ, which is it is filled to the brim with utter humiliation. The one who ought to be and is worthy of ultimate exaltation is instead submitting himself to ultimate humiliation throughout this entire thing. At any moment, he can actually show himself to be the king of power and knock all of these guys down in an instant. But he submits to it because this is all part of what he's come to do.
That's right.
They came up to him, verse 3, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Now, Dan, there's been a lot of ink spilled over this phrase, "Behold the man." But, you know, in context here, I'm not so certain that it means as much as some people would want it to mean. It really does seem to me that Pilate really does want to say, "Look what I've done.
Yeah.
You see, I've shown that I'm willing to go halfway with you. Behold the man."
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing that does jump out with the "behold the man" thing, and this isn't sort of direct dot connection here, but I always think of when Nathan goes to David and tells him this parable about, you know, a guy who had a sheep and he loved this sheep, and there was another guy who had a ton of sheep and all this property, and he had a friend come out in from out of town, and he stole this sheep and killed it to serve it to his friend. And this is all in light of David's murder of Uriah to cover up taking of Uriah's wife and all this kind of stuff. And David's outraged and says that this man will surely pay. And then Nathan says, "You are the man." I always think of when this happens to Jesus and he says, "Behold the man," that David gets forgiven because this is what's going to happen. If you want to know where David's sin is, right? Like, behold this man right here. Here is the man. David is the man that did that. This is the man who is going to take that away. Now, that's just, you know, reading two stories in the Bible and being able to, and having a theology that would say that that is the case. But I think what Pilate's doing is not trying to draw a connection to David, to Jesus. I don't think Pilate's doing that. I think Pilate's doing exactly what you said. I'm drawing that connection. Pilate is saying, "Look at how far I've gone. I've gone pretty far here. Like, I have found no guilt in him. So I did this all for you. Surely this is enough."
And of course, it is not. Verse 6, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Now, of course, Pilate knows that they actually don't have the authority to crucify Jesus. And so this is sort of a quip back to them, like, "Listen, I'm not doing this. I don't want to do this. You deal with it. It's your problem."
Yeah,
but insisting it.
He might even be saying, "Look, if you decide you're going to put this guy to death under your laws, I'll look the other way, but I'm not doing it."
That's right. And it's a very simple reason. I find no guilt in him.
Yeah.
He has not broken Roman law. Nevertheless, the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." There's the charge of blasphemy. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid because he knows how seriously the Jewish leadership takes blasphemy and what they will do in response to him if he doesn't punish this blasphemer. So, verse 9, he entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." So I mean, Jesus, again, is not backing down, but at the same time, he's not pleading his case.
Yeah. So, I mean, Jesus is saying, look, I don't deny that you have the authority to release me or crucify me. You do have that authority. However, all that authority comes from my Father. So my Father has given you that authority. So I am speaking of one whom has higher authority than you, but I am acknowledging that you do have that authority. And then it says, look, and here's the deal, man. And it seems that Jesus is telling Pilate almost that you've really found yourself playing a part in a story that God is writing. And that's why he brings this up, that this authority you have came from. You are a player in this, but the greater sin here is not laid on your shoulders. Yeah, it is laid on the shoulders of those who have rejected me as their Messiah. It's laid on the shoulders of those who have falsely charged me. This is the greater sin. You are just a guy playing a role who has, yes, authority, but has been given that authority from God, who is telling this story right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you can tell Pilate is spooked by this.
And by the way, Pilate doesn't get offended by this. Pilate at this moment is like still trying to figure out how to get himself out of this.
Yeah, that's right. Because it says in verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. And so the Jewish leadership uses the argument that Pilate cannot look away from. I mean, they sort of show their hands as to what they're going to do if he doesn't obey their demands to crucify him. It says the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. Now, this is, of course, the most disingenuous argument of all time, because the Jewish leadership couldn't stand Caesar and had no desire to be his friend at all. I mean, for heaven's sake, they just asked for an insurrectionist to be released.
Think about the hubris in the statement. If you release that guy, you're no friend to Caesar. Never mind that we just asked for the guy who was trying to have an insurrection against Caesar.
It is pretty impressive, the kind of hubris they have. And yet, nevertheless, Pilate does know. I mean, he's a politician. You know, he is a politician, and he knows that this can stir up all sorts of trouble if they, you know, go forward with this claim that Pilate is letting someone who claims to have kingly authority to whatever degree stand up and continue on with their life. This was a problem for him. So when Pilate heard these words, verse 13, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. Again, most disingenuous response of all time.
Well, the order of things here is interesting. So he says to the Jews, behold your king. And the Jews say, away with him, crucify him. So they've been stirred up. This is the madness of a mob. And this is what's been happening. No doubt the Pharisees and religious leaders at this point have spread all of this information through the crowd that he's made himself out to be God. He's a blasphemer. All of this stuff. And if you're going to do the righteous thing here, you are going to call for his death. This is what Moses would want. This is what God would want. So we have to do this. Now, it says that then Pilate says, shall I crucify your king? And it says the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. This, it seems, that is not something that is the mob shouting out or this kind of thing, as much as it is the chief priest being like, dude, we will go
strategically, we've got to do this.
Well, it's just, it seems like the chief priests are like, we'll take this all the way, guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be crazy if the crowd started yelling, we have no king but Caesar. This is something the chief priests are willing to have come out of their mouth in order to get what they want.
Yep. because it and that's really what it's all about, power. I mean, it really is all about influence. And they know that if Jesus continues to live, that they will lose their influence. And so at least that's the way they're thinking. Boy, were they wrong. But so he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the Place of a Skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, "Do not write 'the King of the Jews,' but rather, 'This man said, I am the King of the Jews.'" Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." Now, Pilate may not have known, and probably did not know, the significance of what he had written. Probably did not understand that he was, in fact, making a true statement about Jesus. But nevertheless, that is, in fact, what he has done. He has declared the truth, that Jesus is the King of the Jews. And as the King of the Jews, he is going to show his royalty by being crucified.
Yeah, so here you could tell that Pilate is, I mean, we don't have the washing of the hands happen in John's account. After Pilate has washed his hands of this, he's not going to go, "Okay, let me tear that sign down." And he's got to be so irritated and disgusted with the religious leaders. I mean, if you want to talk about someone that was like irrevocably hardened to a religion, I mean, it's got to be Pilate towards the Jewish established religion, because this is, I'm sure, all very gross to him. And not trying to make Pilate out to be some like noble person.
No, no.
He's a politician working for like a cruel oppressor and all that sort of stuff. But you can tell in these exchanges that this is all insanity to him. And yep. This I have written what I have written is just him saying, "I'm done dealing with you guys."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he just doesn't want to deal with it anymore. And, you know, in the long scheme of things, this is just one more crucifixion in the midst of many, many, many crucifixions that the Roman Empire, commits. And so yes, he has written what he has written. And it says in verse 23, "When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier, also his tunic. But the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, 'Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it shall be.' This was to fulfill the scripture which says, 'They divided my garments in among them, and for my clothing they cast lots.'" Now, of course, that is a reference to Psalm 22, verse 18, and there's a good reason that John quotes from Psalm 22, because if you were to go back and read that psalm, you would see that it basically, it appears as if David is writing from the cross. It appears as a word of prophecy, perfectly depicting the point of view of Jesus from the cross. He even talks about having his hands and feet pierced in that psalm. So that psalm really is a prophetic psalm. If you have not read it before in any detail, it's worth going back to, especially when John makes a note of it here.
Yeah, I mean, this is the my God, why have you forsaken me psalm.
That's right. That's right.
And so, I mean, this isn't the, if you read Psalm 22, and you read the account of the crucifixion,
impossible not to see.
Yeah,
it.
You don't have to be a genius or a biblical scholar to see what's going on there.
That's right. That's right. So the soldiers did these things, but standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. Now, a couple things stick out to me about this part of the narrative. Number one, when virtually all the other disciples left, you have quote, the disciple whom he loves standing nearby. Most of us who read our Bibles, who have done any thinking about this, assume that this disciple whom he loved is the Apostle John, the writer of this gospel.
Yep.
But what sticks out to me is the number of women that stay by his side the entire time.
Yeah.
It's not just his mom. It's not just his mom's sister, but it's Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. These women have been actually quite involved in the ministry of Jesus. We know from Luke's account of Jesus's ministry that some of these women were financial supporters of Jesus, that they were with him really from throughout a significant chunk of his ministry right till the end. John here is also given a charge. And, you know, there's sometimes when I think we read this, when Jesus says to his mother, "Woman, behold your son," that we think that he's saying, "Look at me." It certainly can be. But in the context here, again, because he says, "Behold your son," and then "Behold your mother," it seems that he is actually directing Mary's attention to John the Apostle and saying, from now on, John the Apostle is going to take care of you. And vice versa. John, this is going to be, she's going to be like your mother.
Yeah, and I think now, this might be strange to some people, but I think that there's something here where Mary is commonly referred to as the mother of the church. And now that sounds like a little bit weird in Protestant ears, but it's been that way for a very long time that Mary is considered the mother of the church because Jesus is the founder of the church and Jesus' mother is Mary.
Jesus is the head of the body.
This is correct. And so it's the church of Jesus Christ. His mother is Mary. And it's not weird to me to say that Mary is the mother of the church. It's not weird to me to say that Mary is the mother of God. Is true. And I think in this moment, you have some of that shaping up where he's telling Mary here, "Behold your son." Like this is like that I'm going away, but I'm also not going away. Like the church is going to be established. Like this is your new son. Like this is what's going. This is what has been. This is what has come forth through what you have given birth to, which is Christ, and the church comes from Christ. And then he says to John, "Behold your mother." And this I think is true for all Christians that you could say that Mary is the mother of the church. It is said all nations will call her blessed. She is the one who said, "Let it be to me as you have said," as Angel Gabriel tells her what is going to happen. She is the virgin mother of God. Well, we wouldn't say that she remained a virgin or anything like that, but there is nothing, you can obviously go too far.
In either direction,
with what you do with Mary. We wouldn't say that you would pray to her or venerate her or any of those kind of things.
She's not a co-redemptress.
No, none of this. However, she's not just like, yes, she needs to be died for by Jesus, just like everyone else. But to say that Mary does not play a unique role in redemptive history is ludicrous. I mean,
absolutely.
She is a very important figure, and one of the few people whom Scripture will point out is like highly favored by God. That we are like all nations will call her blessed. This sort of language is not said about just everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yep. And so we ought to honor her.
Yes,
but just in proper. You know, in proportion.
In proportion, correct.
To the degree that the Scriptures honor her, and the Scriptures do honor her.
Yeah, and I think what Jesus is doing here is he's telling Mary that this is not the end, because the church is going to come forth. And he's telling John that in this way, and Jesus uses this familiar language all the time. I mean, you're talking about the same Jesus who has said, you know, when Mary was looking for him, his disciples were saying, "Hey, your mother is trying to find you," and he said, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" You know, those who believe in me. You know,
that's right.
What he's doing is he's saying, "Look, there is something else that is going to happen after this," and he uses familiar language, which is not. This is not the first time he's done that.
That's right. Yep. And so it's a key part of John's gospel, a key part of understanding what is going to happen moving forward. It's a foreshadowing of that. And so we pick it up at verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished, said, "To fulfill the scripture, I thirst." A jar full of sour wine stood there, so they put a sponge full of the sour wine on a hyssop branch and held it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished," and he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Now, of course, many people listening to this will know that the words for "it is finished" is the Greek word tetelestai, and tetelestai is another way of saying paid in full. It's another way of saying it is complete. It was the statement that one would make when, or that one would get stamped on a document declaring that they had paid off a debt. All of that is true. That is significant for us in our understanding of what is actually happening here, that at least part of what is happening here is Jesus is saying, I have accomplished everything that I was set out to do. Yeah. I have fulfilled the mandate given for me. So in this cry, it is finished. Even in this most humiliating of circumstances, it is, though it looks like defeat to everyone around him, it is a cry of victory.
Yeah. I love that these two, that John tags these, that pairs these things up. Now, the first one would be easy to miss, that you have this, I thirst, and this is to fulfill, you know, to fulfill scripture. What's interesting here is that they take a hyssop branch, and they now hyssop is like a spongy kind of shrubbery, right? So yep. They stick it in, so it would absorb up. They use it as a way to absorb things, and so that's why they would dip it in a jar of sour wine, and he could drink from this actual branch. You see this hyssop language appear in the Old Testament. David says in Psalm 51. You know, purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. What does that mean? Well, what it means is like, take this thing away from me. Yes. You would use
absorb
hyssop. Absorb it. It's not an accident that, forget the wine. You can have the wine and you can talk about maybe some things there. But as hyssop is the Old Testament thing that is used in association with cleansing and imputing something to something else, right? So if I washed myself with hyssop, it would remove it from me and absorb it into the hyssop. Jesus then takes this into his mouth. And this is the moment. There's a huge symbolic thing happening here where he is going to now, he's saying, I take all the sins of the world, all that has been taken away from sinners, I take into myself. And this is the, as Paul would say, he who knew no sin became sin. There's an ontological thing that happens there. So he takes it, not just on his shoulders, but takes it into himself, becomes it, owns it. It is now his. That is the moment that he can say, it is finished, because this is the work that he has come to do.
That's exactly right. And that, you know, we ought not forget that also hyssop is used in the Passover. Mm-hmm. Hyssop is used to apply the blood of the lamb over the doorways of the people. So you have hyssop being one of these things that's used all throughout. It's not accidental that all of this is coming together. It, again, to the people that are present there, it looks like defeat. It probably looks like chaos. How can it not? And yet, all of this is fulfilling the plan of God laid out for us for many thousands of years before this, as we read the Old Testament, pointing to this moment where the one who's come to crush the head of the serpent is fulfilling that mandate. He is crushing the head of the serpent even as he is having his heel bitten by the serpent at the crucifixion here.
Yeah, he does all this to bring us back to God. And in this, we are adopted. And that's why some of this language to John even makes sense, that he would say, I'm winning the world back. You are going to become my brother. This is a common language in the Bible that Jesus is our elder brother. And of course, if Jesus is our elder brother, then you can say that Mary is your mother. And that is what he does, all of this stuff as he's like finishing this work. And it's just a way of saying, this job is finished and now everything changes.
That's right. That's right.
And that's it, man. We are out of time, so we will leave it right there. Jesus has died, but next week we've got good news for everyone, so you don't want to miss that episode. Eric, I will see you then.
All right, sounds good.